let's head down to Las Vegas, where I actually worked and lived and survived for 3 years. And I still don't know how John does it, but he does stay in when it gets to be over 150, which is very smart. I always admire that about John. Hello, John.
You dirty rat. I thought, Jimmy Cagney, you dirty rat. You got out of time. Oh, my God. It's been just absolutely and totally, totally brutal. You know, for 3 weeks, it was like 115 degrees. And people would say, oh, it's dry heat. Okay, so now it's 105 degrees, but now it's like 98% humid. So when you had dry heat, you were fried. And now with all this moisture, you're fucking broiled. It's just awful. So anyway, I have never said this before. Oh, but when I was, I always post on Facebook, it's that time of the month, because I love that phrase. It's that time of the month that I was going to be on with Jeff Rentz again. And that after being locked up for 5 weeks, the wonderful thing about being on with Jeff, I get the feeling that I'm going to be able to get out of my house, because after 5 weeks, I'm going out of my mind. But I do have the feeling today, and I've never said this before, that you and I are going to have a very nice time, because more than you or anybody listening, yours truly has to have his spirits lifted. And so I guess the first thing that I could talk about, I guess, is that storm they unfortunately called Hillary? Is that what they called
God.
It?
Now, Hillary, I ran an interesting story about that just briefly. And okay. Hillary was supposed to do a lot more damage, I think, than it did, if you buy into the idea that these things can be controlled and manipulated. But it went east. It went right toward sort of like Las Vegas rather than up into L.A. and the San Fernando Valley and further northeast.
Yeah, listen, that storm called Hillary was certainly a bitch in Los Angeles and Las Vegas, flooded everything. It could have, I mean, it was so hot, it's wonder the water wasn't boiling. But nothing compared to what that murderous real politician bitch called Hillary did in Libya, which was murder Gaddafi.
Right in broad view of the whole world, full view, right on the air. Sickening.
And then go on the air and cackle and say, we came, we saw, we killed, and then she giggled. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So, anyway, oh, my God. So, and anyway, it is Friday, as you know, and yesterday was Thursday. And what was Thursday to most of the world, okay? Thursday was the day that Donald Trump flew in on his airplane and landed and drove to the courthouse in Georgia. I don't know if you saw it. Did you see it?
I did not. I saw the picture of the mugshot, and he doesn't look like a happy fellow. Yes.
Okay, I'll get to the mugshot in a little minute. But I posted this because I felt so sick as I was watching it. I said, oh, my God, please don't tell me that I'm the only sick one that had this weird thought Thursday. That's today, right now, this afternoon. As you know, Trump's plane just landed, and he got into a car headed to the courthouse. And, of course, every network had helicopters in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they were watching him racing down the highway. And all I could see and think of, Jeff, was cameras up in the air following O.J. Simpson's Bronco.
Yes. Who can forget that one? Yes.
So please tell me I'm not alone. Well, I had about two dozen people write to me and said, oh, thank God, John, for you. Because that was crossing my mind, too. So I guess, Jeff, my comments reach a lot of old folks' homes here in Las Vegas and other places. So now we get to the business of the mugshot. Okay. Now, I said absolutely immediately, and I mean immediately, and I laughed when I said it. He'll be, and you can see the expression on his face. You see how stern he is and what he is thinking, you know, is if you're going to get me, I'm going to get you. You have to know that this guy rehearsed his pose for hours in the bathroom or is in his dressing room before he went to the courthouse to get a mugshot. That's the only mugshot like that ever. But I said, he'll be putting on T-shirts immediately and selling millions, and will use the money to build another wall, this time one between him and the prison. And guess what happened this morning?
All true.
Up came his website, and he has already sold $8 million worth of mugs, it's on suitcases, it's on wallets.
Eight million already.
8 million. Wow. You want to know something? Here's an obvious truth, and I'm going to lose another dozen friends for obvious truths. He has made more money being arrested than he ever did building fucking hotels.
That's funny. That's real irony, I guess, when you think about it.
Well,
that's pretty funny.
Now, get this. Not only did that cost me a half a dozen friends. Get this. I posted this fact after that, and it's a little known fact. God, I have I have such smart people as fans, except for those who are interested in Trump. You know, a lot of them don't vote for him, but they don't still think. But anybody interested in Trump has to be an idiot because they're interested in somebody dumber than they are. But anyway, here's a little known fact. This is a fact, and you would appreciate it as a broadcaster. In the last 5 years, Donald Trump has had more actual airtime on MSNBC, CNN, and Fox than all commercials combined. And in 80% of these commercials, there are dire warnings of deadly side effects. But there are no warnings of Trump's side effects, 100% deadly, boring.
Boring. You're having too much fun with this, John.
Listen, I'm not belittling them. I'm just stating obvious facts, hopefully in a humorous way. And people are leaving me in droves. So I put up a post in my, because I felt I was feeling all by myself for a while. And I said, if you have the compulsion or you're one of these personalities that know the truth, and you just cannot keep it to yourself, and you have to verbalize it, you better be a person who enjoys your own company.
Well, you're funny. Well, you approach this the right way. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so now here's the wonderful upshot about this. I got so many positive responses to that. I could not believe it. And one person wrote me a note, a scholar, a historian, paleontologist. He said, John, in 5,000 years, in every single culture in the world, even in hieroglyphics, the Egyptians or everyone wrote about the dangers of telling the truth. And then pointed out that I had one in my own book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin. He said, I recall reading there that you have a 5,000-year-old proverb in there that says, if you're going to tell the truth, you better have one foot in the stirrup. He reminded me of my own work. And then another person who was equally as educated, as astute, even in Africa. And in one African village, the proverb is, if you are going to tell the truth, you are going to be exiled from 8 villages. And as you know, I've been exiled from 8 great shows for telling the truth. Oh, my God.
You have. No, John, that is certainly a hallmark of your fabulous career and all of your contributions. You've never deviated from that. That's who you are. And it's cost you a lot. If you had had sold out and played the game, you would have been a mega millionaire.
Yeah, you know, I would have had a broken heart. I'm going to tell
you. That's right. No, your humor wouldn't have been there because it comes from your heart. I've said this before.
There was also a post this week, a medical post about more and more Americans have died this year from heart attacks than any other year in history. And my response to it was, I do not think it was heart attacks. I think it was heartbreaks. And you know what? I got so many people writing me saying they are so brokenhearted about what is happening to America.
Oh, yeah.
And I must tell you, Jeff, more than anybody, I'm getting really kind of close to that, because a couple of years ago, when I did this really wonderful, truthful 19-minute piece that we probably won't have time to play tonight. It is Why People Still Like Trump, or Why People Love Trump. It's 19 minutes long. Not one bit of it is opinion. It is all fact, which has also cost me a couple of dozen friends that I don't care about. But at the end of it, I said, one of the greatest things about America, the greatest things, is the population, is the people. It's the only country that is made up of every other country in the world. It's a melting pot.
Yeah, sure.
But you know what has happened with that melting pot? If you're a chef, Jeff, and you put carrots and potatoes and salmon and broccoli and cheese and everything into a melting pot, what happens to it? It becomes one. And Americans have become one huge blob of malleable putty. And what they do as this blob that has not one individual in them is they continue every year to put absolute, total, criminal, incompetent, thieving crooks into the Senate, into the Congress, and worst of all, into the White House. I mean, are Joe Biden and Donald Trump the best that this country can do? You know what that's like? That's like playing the World Series with the two worst teams. So now I'm down to the point where I think the greatest stuff in America is just the topography. But thank goodness for some magnificent, magnificent friends. And thank God for the Donald Jeffries of the world, the Leno Sanics of the world. Thank God for you, Jeff, Chuck Ocelli. I mean, these are the few things that sort of keep me going. Wow. And one of the persons that keep me going is somebody who is by far the most intelligent, most well-read, brightest, original human being I have ever met, but I've never met her. Her name is Alexandra Miletic, and she lives in Serbia.
In Serbia, yes.
Yeah. Now, first off, from the time she was 9 years of age, she went to every single movie she could see, and they were mostly American movies. Of course, she would watch European movies because that's where she lived. But at nine, she kept notebooks of reviews of those movies, and she has hundreds of these notebooks. So she was totally thrilled when she got Carol Hennig's book saying the greatest reviews I ever read. She read it three or four times. She absolutely loved it. And on Facebook, not only did she write the greatest review I have ever read, including some that I have written, it was more than a review. It was an essay on the decline of American movies and American culture, which is dragging down even her European country, and especially Serbia, where she lives. Now, she posted something that you will absolutely love. How long did you live in Los Angeles?
Me?
Yeah, you.
I grew up in Newport Beach, primarily. And I lived my earliest years in Inglewood up until about the age of six. Inglewood used to be white middle class. My father was a sports writer for the L.A. Daily News. He was one of the biggest.
Wow.
He was one of the biggest sports writers of all. And he covered the Rams when they were world champions and all that. And we lived in Inglewood, and it was wonderful. He used to take us for a drive over by the airport, the L.A. International Airport, and we'd watch the D.C. Sixes and D.C. Sevens land. And it was a small airport then, and now it's a megalith.
But you were well aware, obviously, of Hollywood and the Sunset Strip.
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to go. My grandmother married she married a French chef. He was a chef at Ciro's for 10 years, worked for Herman Hoover. And I was taken into Ciro's on several occasions to visit my grandfather, the chef there. And I got to see it as a little kid.
Okay,
and I remember being driven down Sunset and Hollywood in my grandmother's car. And we'd see Earl Carroll's. We'd see the Mogambo and all that. I saw it all.
Okay, you just mentioned it. Mogambo. This came from Alexandra. I mean, it's just stunning. Oh, my God. Hang it up. Here it is. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Here is a picture and a note from her. She posted it. In the 50s, Ella Fitzgerald was not allowed to play Mogambo, Hollywood's most popular nightclub. Marilyn Monroe, who was a big fan of hers, called the owner and told him, if he booked Ella Fitzgerald, she would be there every single night, which guaranteed huge press coverage. Ella was booked, and Marilyn was there at the front table every single night, Jeff. Ella Fitzgerald said, after that, I never had to play a small jazz club again. Marilyn was an unusual woman ahead of her time. Now, imagine, this comes from a lady in Serbia, so of course I had to comment on it, and this is how I commented on it. Okay, hang on a second. Oh, my God. I mean, that came from, and then the other thing is about Barbie and Oppenheimer. Okay, so let me see if I can find
that. We'd love to get you to talk. Now, I've got your 88th queued up, but let's keep talking, because talking with you is gold, and we want to hear the 88th. But I'm telling you, when I was a little kid getting to see Ciro's several times from the inside, and my grandfather was a best friends with Clark Gable, Mario Lanza, Errol Flynn. He used to go to Errol Flynn's parties. He told me later on that they were pretty wild, And he knew everyone. And he was a celebrity because the chefs back then would walk through the dining room making sure that everyone's food was right and talk it up with the celebrities and the stars. And he was a very interesting man. Very interesting. I was very, very fortunate.
Well, you were fortunate. And I must tell you, you do a wonderful job on the radio. And you have a much better voice than anybody I ever hear talking on the radio. It's not deep like Orson Welles, but it's very comfortable. Anyway, this is what I wrote back to Alexandra. I said, this Alexandra is an absolutely historic, important post. After Marilyn Monroe made it possible for Ella to perform at the Mogambo, this is where I saw Tina Turner's first solo performance after she left her brutalizing husband, Ike. It is also where my girlfriend, Sarita, now my wife, introduced me to her friend, Red Fox, who became my mentor as a comic and my only lifelong friend in show business. And, of course, I got to perform at the Mogambo myself. This important find from somebody in Serbia proved once again, Alexandra, that you are indeed an international treasure. Now, we're going to get to the business about, because a number of people have asked me to go and review Oppenheimer. Or Barbie, as a matter of fact. But before we do that, would you play the 88-year-old birthday thing? And the reason I say that is that Alexandra pointed out to me, she went to see Match Point, Woody Allen's film. She has very mixed feelings about Woody because of his personal life, but she said he's made three genius films, and she pointed them out, and she was right. And the closing shot in Match Point is nothing but expressing good luck or bad luck. And a year ago, Woody Allen confessed to the fact that the most important thing in his life was good luck. So he went to Paris to make a film to prove that the most important thing in a person's life is good luck. So I will go to see that film, not because I'm a fan of Woody's, but I'm an enormous fan of Alexandra's. So I'm going to go see it. And I do understand about good luck. So could you please play the thing about 88? Because I still get questions every day. John, how do you get to live to be 90? And I just say, don't die at 89. What else?
Come on. See, that's one of those very quick little shorties by John that comes right out and just nails it. You nail it. It's perfect. You and Mark Twain would have been best of pals.
God. You're such a gem. Anyway, could you play that?
Yeah, and we're all set.
Ready okay, go ahead.
All right, here we go.
I never, ever thought or planned about becoming 88. As a matter of fact, I almost never thought about age one day in my life. To me, today's like any other day, here for 24 hours, then gone. It's true, most people I know my age are dead. And almost half the people I know, half my age, live as they appear to be. I was always way too busy trying to live and survive or succeed each day to be counting them. I was trying to live a full life, not a long one. And, of course, counting this far, every day I get questions on what is the secret of living this long. Folks, I hate to tell you this, but there is no secret. Just a few simple, obvious truths. And as most of you know, truths finish second to beliefs with most people. I never, ever give advice, not even to family or my very few close friends, but as an emotional 8-year-old, I am a happily compulsive truth teller. So here are the three truths about living a long life. It requires three things: nature, nurture, and The Unknown Mystery of Luck. So let's start with nature. Nature gives you life, but only you can give it purpose. Nature gave us perfect bodies, but imperfect minds. Nature does not give a hoot about your politics or religion or beliefs or anything else, or basically even you, just the species. Nature is only interested in the three F's: fornicating, fighting, and feeding. We were designed to fight and feed to fornicate. You do not worry about some molecule in your heart or lungs working right. You only care that the organ it is in is functioning. That is nature, only concerned that the mystery of all life, not just ours, continues. To that end, nature has supplied each of us with our own fountain of youth. The fountain of youth is a frequent, pleasant expulsion of sperm. Hopefully with someone.
This is a family program.
And because it's made so pleasurable, the biggest waste in nature is sperm. Especially some of it that takes. We see that in many of our politicians and our ex-best friends. Nature gave us perfect bodies. They require eating, mostly to kill to eat, and defecating. Our bodies are designed to get rid of the crap we don't need. It doesn't need. Sadly, our minds are not. We see that also in most politicians and ex-best friends who have minds that believe the crap they choose to retain. Fortunately for me, I got rid of a lot of that when I was 6 years old, which brings me to nurture. Having two horrible human beings as parents, home was hell. Being away from it, even at that young age, no matter the calamities that befall me, was heaven. Of course, in the surrounding culture, I wanted to believe in a God and a Santa Claus. But at six, when I saw two different fat men in red suits with fake beards in two different department stores the same day, my mind defecated Santa immediately. God followed soon thereafter, with thousands and thousands of unanswered prayers about getting me out of this living hell. Ever since then, I have looked on every pontiff and preacher as a distracting, misinforming, money-making myth-maker, except for the entertaining Reverend Ike of the 50s who said, quote, God didn't make junk, unquote. When your skin is cut, it heals tougher where a scar is in the cut places. If you can train yourself to think clearly, and that does require training, your heart will do the same. Heal tougher in the cut and broken places. One of the truest things Shakespeare ever said in Hamlet is, quote, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking doth make it so, unquote. Like everyone, I've had my heart broken dozens and dozens of times, but never my spirit or my joy at just being alive and far away from hell. So, this brings me to luck. How is it that a kid from a dysfunctional family who never wants to marry or have a kid because of it ends up with the most fabulously supportive wife in the world, and a child who is one of the three geniuses and joys I've known? Luck. Deported twice, quit the business and show business, and unemployed and unemployable at 46. Then, accidentally, a year later, has the most watched, influential show in television history, Real People, on the air. luck. Or becomes a private writer for 4 years to the most influential performer in America, Frank Sinatra. Or the Boswell to this country's bravest soul, Jim Garrison, and getting to tell his amazing American story of his solved, sabotaged investigation into the murder of John F. Kennedy in two films. All in a life totally, totally unplanned. Just lived. Just pursued. Luck. Many who've read my book have told me and sent me notes that say it had to be divine intervention. It may well have been. I cannot comprehend the source, and neither can they. No one can, but I do appreciate the results. The scores and scores of times when even I thought all was hopelessly over with, up would pop from nowhere a perfect stranger to bring me luck. Now, since I'm 88, long past the time when nature needs me or makes me capable of reproducing more of her species, I get questions on then what keeps me going. Well, folks, I can answer that truthfully also. What keeps me going is rage and laughter. To me, there are countless, countless cruel calamities, especially in my favorite country, to rage about. But luckily, also for me, they are often the same things to laugh at. I started by saying I never, ever give advice, and I don't. So just consider this a suggestion. To be really, really happy and to live a long, fruitful, and productive and happy life, think less, daydream more, then follow that dream. And finally, good luck.
Now, that is sweet. That is really, really elegant, and it's a timeless piece. This will be up in John's columnist section if it's not already there. Now, that's John Barber talking about turning 88. He's 90 now. He's 90 now, and there are lessons in there for all of us. Those are really great words. You know what? Yeah. Let me say one other thing, please. Okay. You do something. Most comics and many others who fashion themselves as being funny or humorous, they'll lay out a line or two on the Tonight Show or whatever, and they'll laugh at it. They'll laugh at their own humor, but it doesn't work. It comes across as self-indulgent, as narcissistic. When you say something funny, you laugh at it as if it's coming from someone else, and you're genuinely... You're genuinely amused.
Well, because
that is something I've never heard, John. You honestly laugh at your own humor, honestly.
Well, sometimes I feel like I'm channeling Mark Twain, for God's sake. It's really a
wouldn't be surprised.
And you know, I love the fact that when you were younger, you loved my movies, and just because of you and a couple of other people, including Alexandra in Serbia, she urged me to go to see Oppenheimer. So I have reviewed it for you guys. But before I do, I just want to read to you what she wrote to me about when she went to see Oppenheimer. Is it okay?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
She says... Oh,
can I say one other thing real quick?
Sure,
I really want to say this. Not only did I really adore your reviews, I would gear my week around. I was going to the University of California, Santa Barbara then, and I would be sure and be home when you had a review. I never missed one, I don't think. And they made for me an actual inspiration. I was just getting into broadcasting then. about what I wanted to try to do and the ethics I wanted to try to espouse and embrace. And I want to thank you again. Those reviews were the most unpretentious, brilliant commentaries on entertainment that you'll ever hear, that I've ever heard. Go ahead.
Okay. She wrote me this note. She said, John, I got really upset last night. In the line to buy the ticket for Oppenheimer, the same movie theater shows both Oppenheimer and Barbie, the line for the Barbie movie was three times longer, mostly teen and post-teen girls and a few, well, let's call them boys, in quote. The basic premise of that movie is what? Rich, clueless blonde with her rich, equally clueless boyfriend and friends living their posh, empty, shallow, consumeristic lives, and that's the one and only message to young girls: do whatever it takes to get rich if you were not already born rich, live a shallow, meaningless, prosaic, hedonistic life. In my book, that's the real pornography, worse than anything invented in the minds of Larry Flint or Hugh Hefner or anything you could see on any porn site. Total and utter pornography of brainwashing. And then she sums it up by saying, Debbie Does Dallas. Oh my God. And then one guy wrote, do you know why Barbie never got pregnant? Do you know why Barbie never got pregnant? I'm asking you, Jeff.
Oh God, I didn't see the movie. I don't know. I could think of estrogen overdose for the guy for openers.
No,
go ahead.
Because Ken comes in another box. That's disgusting. Okay, here's the review of Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer is the story of the man and scientist who was known as the father of the atom bomb, one of which may or may not have been necessary to end the war with Japan. The second one dropped on Nagasaki was totally unnecessary, according to almost every sane
human
on the planet, but not to America's inhuman military-industrial complex. But before starting this three-hour film, they should have dropped a third one on the orchestra pit. There are almost no moments in this movie at least 20 seconds long so that we can hear the dialogue, a lot of which is convoluted physics anyway, where we are not distracted by the band. When I go to a film or pick up a book, fiction or nonfiction, or watch a television series, I say simply, just tell me a story. As an abandoned six-year-old, I was saved by listening to or watching endless, endless stories with a passion. I learned early that stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. And the best of them sometimes have flashbacks, which add to the dimension and texture to both the characters and the story. With books, it was the excitement of opening the cover. With films, it was the anxiously awaiting to get past who was making it or who was in it. I just wanted it to begin. Oppenheimer happily began immediately, but got unhappy real quick. We see a restless college student maybe having nightmares of universes or galaxies or planets bursting into flame. Then we think, oh, this is Oppenheimer. He is just seeing in his mind as a young physicist what he is thinking about, or maybe the explosions we're going to see later over Hiroshima. And the explosions were not as loud as the orchestra. I was hoping for my first flashback so I could see him as a young boy with his brother maybe playing or going to synagogue or chatting around the table with his mother and father talking about corned beef sandwiches or maybe seeing how glib and attractive he was to girls, since later he's accused by his detractors and the FBI as a womanizer. None of that happens. And as the film continues and the band plays on, I discovered there is no middle. And since the director and the writer did not give us any flashbacks to inform us as to how Robert was shaped into this genius, they give us a bunch of very distracting fast forwards. Mm-hmm. Only someone deeply, deeply knowledgeable about World War II and the time of the blacklisting and the commie-hating Bill of Rights and Constitution-destroying insanity in America at that time, we are mm-hmm. more sadly heir to today, would understand what was going on. We are now in the middle of the film and discover we are just spectators at the building of the bomb, but in no way emotionally attached to its builder. The one person who seems totally together is the general who hires Oppenheimer to head up and build Los Alamos and the bomb in 1942. The general is played brilliantly by Matt Damon. Then we get to the end, and for some reason do not see what the bombs did to either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But it's at the end that I felt the story began. And the story was a mini version of an Othello. His Iago is an equally brilliant Robert Downey Jr., who plays Strauss, who'd do anything to become part of the government's cabinet. And in order to get there, he has to totally destroy Oppenheimer. Now the world's most famous scientist, even more popular than Einstein. And he has to destroy him with an avalanche of lies and a coterie of lying lawyers, which we all know can be found anywhere, especially in the Senate. It would have been a much better ending had we seen early a little bit of Strauss's plotting and plannings against Oppenheimer, like Iago. And personally, I would have loved to have learned more about what was shaping and who was shaping Robert Oppenheimer at 6 years of age. We do not see the credits till the end when half of the people had already left. For a moment, I thought they were going to list the conductor and the band members first. As for Robert Downey Jr., the worst thing about his name is the Jr. As one of the greatest, or if not the greatest, most natural living film actor in the world, he is Jr. to no one. That's it.
Well, that's a good point. Nice way to end that. It was very nice of you to read her comments and commentary on the film. I haven't seen the film either, so I assume the orchestra references must, there must be some period music that they're constantly interspersing in the plot line.
It is not. If it had been period music, it'd been different. And you know, I got a most wonderful note from Gail Nix Jackson. You know who Gail is? Gail Nix Jackson is the daughter of Orville Nix, who took that spectacular film in 1963 from the opposite side of the book depository, shooting toward the fence, and there are obviously shots coming from the fence, and that film was confiscated and is still being held by the federal government, and it's taking her, Gail, forever and ever to try and get her father's film back. She just wrote me a beautiful note an hour ago before we went on the air.
Oh, nice.
She said, John, I absolutely and totally loved that movie. And I loved it so much, I'm going to go back and see it again. But I must tell you also, I absolutely and totally agree with everything you say in your review. And I love that too, because it is so barbaresque.
Barbaresque. There you go.
There you
That's the
go.
kind of word we like to see. I haven't
That's.
seen it. I don't know if I will. I go back. I just got to go back to Hollywood just for a couple of minutes. We lived there from, I think I was, 4, 5, and 6. The first 3 years were like Inglewood. And at one point, we lived up near Dodger Stadium, before they built Dodger Stadium. And
Yes,
I remember
it
being in my crib, John, holding on and looking down the hill at the streetcars going by on whatever boulevard was down there. And I was less than a year old, and I remember that. And we ended up
Oh.
living in Hollywood, and we always had. Now, do you remember this? Do you remember the Helms Bakery trucks?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, that was like Christmas early. And when those trucks came down the neighborhood and the guy was blowing his whistle, we knew those trucks, which smelled like bakeries on wheels, and they were full of the most fresh, wonderful baked goods you could imagine, were going to stop in front of our house. And they did.
But better than that, and you probably remember them too, I hope you do. Los Angeles had one of the best public transportation systems in the
Oh, the red
world.
cars, of course. Yes.
Yeah, the red electric cars.
Yep.
I mean, I took them everywhere. I took them to the San Fernando Valley. I took them to the Pacific Ocean. I took them downtown. I took them everywhere.
You could
And
ride all
then
day for a nickel. Yeah.
you could ride everywhere for a nickel. And then, of course, you had the auto industry led by Ford and General Motors. They moved in and they bought the city council and they removed all the cars and made all those politicians making
Real,
millionaires.
30 seconds. Let me tell you exactly what happened.
Okay.
Firestone Tire and Rubber, General
Yeah.
Motors coach, meaning bus,
Yes.
got together and with Standard Oil of Ohio formed a dummy corporation, came in and bought up the controlling interest in the Pacific Electric stocks and ran the thing into bankruptcy and destroyed it so they could put in their gas stations and freeways and sell cars and diesel buses. That's how it was done.
And that's it. And you know, that's how America is run today. And you know, Sarita asked me the other day, who's the guy that they changed the name of the airport here? The senator from some small hick town in Nevada.
It's not McCarran anymore?
No, it's not McCarran anymore.
No.
Oh, yes, he was. And a matter of fact, I wrote a public letter. It was the first, it was one, I wrote it 8 years ago, where I, the first time ever in my life, I used the F word in Harry Reid.
Oh,
Harry
God, they didn't
Reid's.
name it after Harry Reid.
Yes, but get this,
Oh, no.
eight
Oh,
years
no.
ago, he's on the
Yeah.
floor of the Senate voting to give an additional $30 million a day to Israel. So
I
what
know.
I did is I tracked all the names of the neocons, and there were 22 of them. And these 22 neocons had dual citizenship. They were all, you know, Israeli Americans, okay? They played the major part in getting Bush into going into Iraq. And I wrote this scathing note saying that Teddy Roosevelt said 100 years ago, nobody should hold that position who's not 100% American. And I said, hey, you don't see any Irish Americans there. You don't see any Mexican Americans there. You don't see Scotch Americans there, Russian Americans there. They're all Jewish Americans, okay? So I decimated the rant, people called it a rant, with pictures and names and everything, got
Right.
85,000 hits in 2 weeks. 2 weeks. And it was up for 6 years ago. Now, 2 years ago, I get a note from Google and they tell me I have to take it down. It offends community standards today. And I said, hold it a second. I sent a note because you can't talk to a human being at Google. I sent him a note. I said, hey, it's the same community standards that you had 8 years ago. Could you send me a booklet of your new community standards? Well, I never got a booklet, but I got a note said, if you do not take it down, your site will be blocked and defunded. So I called my son and complained about it and thought, oh, my God, Christopher, America's getting worse and worse. And he said, well, Dad, you know, people have seen it, so take it down. So I took it down. There. It's down. There you go.
Well, listen, I wish we had another hour. I know most of our listeners do, too. You have friends all around the world, John, who just really would love to shake your hand and say thank you. I know a lot of them think that way. So we'll talk next. Yeah, go ahead.
Next, I may only do one more thing on Facebook and never be on Facebook on camera or on Word again after November 22nd. Anyway, I can't wait till next month, because it'll be before November 22nd, and we will chat again. And thank you for being there, because you lifted my spirits a great deal, and I needed
thinking. It works both ways. You give Sarita a hug. Hi, Sarita. And, Johnny, we'll talk soon. I'm here if you need anything.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeff. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Okay. The one and only Mr. John Barber. He is an American treasure, if there ever was one. Okay, thanks for being here. You're appreciated, and have a good weekend. Take care. Back with you on Monday night.